So I wanted to discuss with you some issues in analyzing networks of interaction in biological data. And the talk's primarily going to focus on interactions between amino acids, although I'm going to touch on how some of the general ideas apply to other sorts of interactions. And in fact, we're starting to work on other sorts of interactions, the interactions among gene products and genetic regulatory networks, using some of these same ideas. So let's start with some data. And as I say, the case study here is really going to be interactions among amino acids. And then I'll point out where I think things generalize to other sorts of to other sorts of interactions. So what do we got for data? Well, databases are now full of sequences, and we have many, many, many sequences which are all assumed to fold to a common structure. And so I've taken a slice of one of these variable sequence families, and I've put down some of the sequences on this slide. And if we focus on any pair of positions in this family of aligned sequences, and typically we're going to be getting our sets of aligned sequences just straight out of PFAM, which is a hidden Markov model alignment. And you look at any pair of columns like those that I've outlined in green, then as you go from sequence to sequence, the amino acids are changing in one column, and the amino acids are also changing in the other column. Now, conventional dogma would say that the mutations which occur in different positions of a sequence are independent of each other. However, it becomes immediately apparent that if you actually go in and look at some of the data that's available, there is in fact statistically significant correlations of the mutations in different pairs of positions in aligned sets of sequences that fold to the same structure. Now, I'm going to be talking a lot about sort of analysis of just this block of data, looking at covariation of mutations between different pairs of positions. But mentally keep in the back of your mind that this could equally well be a block of data from global gene expression studies, in which case you would have, instead of sequences going down the page, genes going down the page. And instead of sequence positions going across the top, that is, each column being a sequence position, each column would be an experimental condition under which you're measuring gene expression. And in the gene expression case, instead of having discrete variables, the 20 amino acids, you of course have the continuous measures of gene expression level. So just keep that in mind, and I'll come back and touch on the issues as they apply to gene expression as we go through the talk. Now, let's suppose we go to PFAM and we extract a block of aligned sequences, and it was done by a hidden Markov model, strictly a pure sequence alignment methodology. It used nothing about structure. And we look at columns, perhaps this pair of green columns, and we see the statistically significant covariation. Now, I typically measure covariation with data like this by mutual information, and I'll come to just what the definition of that is in a second if you're not familiar with it. But you know, obviously there's some way you can cook up a measure of covariation for data like this. What could be causing covariation between sequence positions, which might in fact be very, very far apart on the sequence? What could be causing the covariation of mutations in those positions? Well, we and many other people have thought it would be nice to explain it by saying, even if the pair of positions which have correlated mutations are very, very far apart on the sequence, when they're folded up together in the final tertiary structure, they're next to each other. And what's going on is compensating mutations in order to preserve the structure. This then gives you the idea that you might attempt to investigate the structure from sequence problem by generalizing it so that it's structure from sequences. And what you could do is go in, look for statistically significant covariation between pairs of positions, and say, aha, under this hypothesis, I'm going to predict that pairs of positions which display statistically significant covariation are close together in the final structure. And if I can get even a small set of accurately predicted contacts like that, it can be very useful in these ab initio forward folding codes because it places significant constraints on the conformation space. So from the protein sequence standpoint, that's going to be our goal. And I should mention right off that this naive idea is pretty much, although we and other people have published a fair amount on it, a dismal failure. I'll explain why, and then I'll explain the algorithms that really give you considerably more success than the simplistic idea.
How big a job it is to make sure that you're looking at like orthologous sequences and you're filtering out very closely? I mean, you need to have sort of a fair sample of the sequence.
You do. Ideally, you do. And in fact, I have a slide, I think, or at least a comment or two later on. But I think what Terry's driving at is that this set of sequences is not an independent sample from some universe of sequences. They're related by a shared ancestry. They're related by a phylogenetic tree. And in fact, as we and other people have shown, if you take a phylogenetic tree and then you evolve sequences down that tree where the mutations that occur in the different positions of the sequence are, in fact, independent because you're evolving them on a computer. The mere fact that you're evolving them down the tree and then you look at them at the bottom of the tree and then calculate a mutual information measure, the mere fact that the sequences have a shared ancestry gives you artifactual correlations between the positions. This is a topic that we and other people are interested in. For the purposes of this talk, what I'm going to do is ignore that effect because I think there's an important effect which people haven't investigated at all. And I want to show you the results from just ignore this phylogenetic issue and investigate this other effect that I claim is important and watch the accuracy go up. We're going to come back to the phylogenetic issue in the future.
I think Frank's actually asking a slightly different question.
Oh.
He asked about orthologs, sorry, in the context of catalogs. What you really want is sequences that you think all share the common structure. And certainly orthologs just have a shared function too. But even most catalogs, as long as they're within a certain range of each other, I mean, all the tubulin molecules, the alpha, beta, gamma, delta, they all simply have the same overall fold. So you have to be a little bit careful that you're not taking sequences that are completely unrelated, but they can be pretty physically related.
Okay.
Still have the same structure.
Well, then another issue is that you don't want to have in your sequence half of them coming from very closely related section of the tree.
Well, that gets quite a good issue. Yeah, you have right. Clusters that are different, then they're still not independent samples. So you have a situation where you both are independent, but it doesn't really matter for orthologs as long as there's reason to believe or know that they really share the same structure. So that's what you're trying to get at.
Again, for the
uninitiated,
orthologs and paralogs are different.
Orthologs mean it's the same proteins that have been divided by speciation. So the human alpha globin, the ortholog of the mouse alpha globin. Okay, the alpha globin and beta globin are paralogs. They're within a species. They're duplications that have taken on really similar, but they can have different functions.
Alpha beta are paralogs.
Okay. What I want to concentrate on is methods to analyze networks of interactions, because there's some very interesting things that go on when you don't stop at pairwise statistics. You look at a particular pair of positions and you calculate a correlation or a mutual information between what's going on at the pair of positions or pair of genes. if you have networks of interactions, life can get much more complicated and much more interesting. So that's where I want to go, but I first ought to say, just for the data that I presented there, you have a particular pair of positions. It's discrete data. It's not continuous data. If it's continuous data, like gene expression values, you know, you calculate a standard correlation value, and maybe you cluster the genes, and I think you're going to run into all sorts of trouble that way. And I'll come back to why. If it's discrete data, what do you do for a covariation measure? Probably you've all seen this before, but from a finite set of data like that, you can estimate the pairwise probability distribution, PAB, just by frequency counting. And what you want is a measure of, does PAB factorize into PA times PB? In other words, are the two positions independent of each other? And a measure of that is mutual information. You can write it in many different forms. I don't know which form you like. I happen to write it this way. You can write it in terms of entropies. But basically, you see that the mutual information M will be zero when PAB factorizes because you're taking log of one. And you can prove that it's actually always greater than or equal to zero. For the results I'm going to describe, we're going to stick with the 20, but we've also used similarity between the amino acids to try and cut down the alphabet as well. That doesn't really seem to help that much in this problem. Right. It does, but you have to know how to group the amino acids, and isoleucine is equivalent to leucine in basically all situations. Well, it's true to some general extent, but there's specific situations in which it's not. So, yes, you do cut down the alphabet size, and so the amount of data you have is larger relative to the alphabet size, which is nice for estimating these pairwise probabilities. On the other hand, unless you group things properly, you're going to lose information. And we found, generally speaking, that grouping things didn't really help much in this problem. But okay, so that was a strictly pairwise measure. And if you go into PFAM and you extract aligned sets of sequences and you say, I'm going to use that measure to predict who's in contact with who, because you also know the structure for some of these alignments, or a lot of these alignments, it doesn't work very well for proteins. On the other hand, for RNA molecules, if you apply this same idea, and Gary and others have done this for RNA molecules to determine RNA secondary structure, it in fact, works fairly well. So what's the difference between trying to apply this idea to RNA molecules and applying it to protein molecules? Well, the difference that we've concentrated on is the following, and presumably there could be other differences which are contributing to why the algorithm works differently in the two cases. But what we thought might be going on is the fact that in RNA molecules, the interactions between the bases are hydrogen bonds, and hydrogen bonds typically saturate. So that if you've got these two guys bonded, he's not going to typically go bond with a bunch of other guys. In protein molecules, where the things that are interacting in some sense are the amino acids, the interactions are much more diffuse. So if you have an interaction between this fellow and this fellow, he can go interact with this fellow, he can interact with this fellow, he can interact with this fellow. So in fact, it's possible to think of a situation where you have diffuse interactions, where you have this position is proximate to this position, and you have correlated mutations between them. The next finger is proximate to the third finger and you have correlated mutations, and so on down a chain. By the time you get a few steps down the chain, the little finger will still be correlated with the thumb, but they're not proximate in space. Now, for physicists who immediately think of the Ising model when you have chains of interactions like this, you'd say, well, the correlations decay fairly rapidly down the chain, so probably this is not a particularly big issue. That's probably a correct intuition if you're considering something like the Ising model where you have one-dimensional chain of interactions that are connecting two positions. However, in a folded-up protein molecule, you can have many indirect paths of interaction between any two amino acids going all the way throughout the protein. And as I'll show you, it turns out that if you have a situation where you have many indirect paths of interaction between two positions, there can be no term in the Hamiltonian, no direct interaction between the two positions, and yet by, in a sense, summing up all of the correlations that go through all the indirect paths, the two not connected positions will have a greater covariation or a greater correlation than any pair of directly connected positions in the system. So, and I'll demonstrate that in some detail. So, the sort of common sense intuition sort of depends on your viewpoint. If you're a physicist and understand these things perhaps up front, you might not think this is common sense. But when you give this talk to biological audiences, and they're used to saying, oh, well, these things are correlated, very highly correlated, therefore they must be interacting in some way. And you say, well, no, I'll show you examples where these things have the highest correlation in the system of interacting nodes, and yet they're the ones that are not directly connected. They find that a little bit paradoxical. And this chaining phenomenon, the fact that when you have many indirect paths of communication between two nodes, that you can have a correlation between those nodes which is bigger than any other correlation in the system, including directly connected nodes, is one of the reasons why we think that the naive approach of just looking at pairwise correlation and saying if the pairwise correlation is high, the amino acids are close together in physical space, or if the correlation is high, the genes obviously have some kind of direct interaction between them. This chaining phenomenon will violate that sort of prediction.
In the context of chain question analysis, is the money sort of a question?
Well, basically, everybody takes a pairwise measure of correlation for genes and does stuff with it. Because you're assuming that if the pairwise correlation is high, it means.
No,
this includes all possible pairwise correlations between all possible positions.
Our KKY stimulus has exactly the long range interaction and you can have the situation you describe. If I flip a spin here, I ask, how does the ground state change? The one over here will be more likely to flip than the one next to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are certain models of stimulus, not all of them, which will do what you say.
Well, I'll give you an explicit model here.
But anyway, I thought as Terry was implying that the mining was sort of building up that kind of picture, and you could describe it by an effective set of JRJs in a similar model. It wouldn't necessarily literally be true that there's interaction with those to the other side of the system. But the effective interaction, because of exactly what you say, some sort of
Well, there's a difference between what Dominique was doing and what I'm going to describe here. Let me go ahead and describe what I'm doing here, and then we can come back to that. Actually, what I wanted to do is, because this generally tends to be a tough crowd, is insert at least one slide of results, because it seems like every speaker doesn't get to the final results. So, hopefully, you'll let me describe the algorithm if you see the results first. And of course, R curve is at the top, and being at the top means you're doing better than other methods. And in particular, what this is is a particular protein structure domain called PDZ, from which we extracted 274 sequences out of the PFAM alignment. And we attempted to, the structure of this is known, multiple structures are known, and they all overlap to a fairly good degree. And we attempted to predict contacts in two ways. One, what I'm calling the naive, pairwise, mutual information way. And two, brand A, our algorithm, which takes into account all the networks of interactions. And this is a specificity sensitivity plot, which I hope is a familiar sort of plot to you. And what this is showing is that our algorithm, just by eyeballing the two curves, seems to be doing significantly better than the naive algorithm. So I'm going to come back to the results. I just wanted to throw a slide of results on in the hopes that I could actually get through the algorithm and describe the results.
44 was the number of the
data. Yeah, length.
Length.
Let's see. So this is still work in progress, and I'm going to give some results on PDZ, some results on SH3, and I'm debating right now if I should even mention results on hemagglutinin. I think I'll try and do it briefly. Hemagglutinin is an important protein in flu, and I happen to be funded to think about flu, and so although I'm particularly interested in this problem, it occurred to me that I could actually apply it to hemagglutinin and get funding to think about this issue of covariation. I've set up the hypothesis that you can have these networks of correlations extending throughout a protein, and in fact, you can have two positions which are far apart, and no direct energetic connection between them. And yet the correlations will be higher than even those that might be directly connected. Is there any, apart from launching into the algorithm, is there any other reason to think that this might be going on in proteins? Well, let's look at hemagglutinin. There are a heck of a lot of sequences in the sequence database because you get your flu shot every year, and there's a lot of sequencing which is going on to determine what goes into your flu shot. And we calculated mutual information, M, and the distance between the C alphas, the carbon alpha, of each amino acid. And what I've selected on this slide are pairs of positions where you have high mutual information. For example, between position 189 and 133, the mutual information is 0.83. And the distance is 21 angstroms. So these guys are not close together in the hemagglutinin molecule. However, between 189 and 183, there's a statistically significant mutual information of 0.58, and they're about 6 angstroms apart. Between 193 and 155, there's statistically significant mutual information of about 0.21, and they're 8.8 angstroms apart. And then finally, from 153 to 133, it's the same story. So in hemagglutinin, we traced through and found that for a lot of the positions that displayed high statistically significant mutual information but were 20 angstroms apart, you could find a path where you have statistically significant mutual information along the path, and every member of the path was, say, within 10 angstroms of each other. It doesn't prove that chaining, as I'm talking about, exists, but it makes you think it's worth further analysis.
Is there some formula that says the mutual information between 189 and 133 is the sum over all possible paths and products of mutual information along the way?
I'll pay you later. Let's see, I think that's the next slide. It's not, but I'll come exactly to that. And we have a FISREV article on that. Okay, so I haven't told you what we're doing with networks. All I've mentioned is mutual information and just strictly pairwise measures of covariation. And remember that we've got a finite set of data, like that set of sequences that I had in the first slide, where the two green columns were highlighting positions that were distant along the sequence but had statistically significant mutual information. What else can you do with that slide of data other than calculate mutual information? How do you start getting at network aspects of interactions? Well, the way we thought about it is it's a maximum entropy problem. You have a finite set of data. It's really only enough to estimate by frequency counting first order moments and second order moments, pairwise probability distributions. So given estimates of the first order moments and the second order moments of a probability distribution, what's the probability distribution that has those moments? It's completely ill-defined. Many probability distributions will have given first and second order moments. But you can ask, what is the probability distribution that is the flattest or simplest that has those given first and second order moments? You can ask for the probability distribution that has maximal entropy, so it's spread out as much as possible, and yet it has those given first and second order moments. And so this is a classic problem in maximum entropy analysis, which you might well have seen before in other contexts. You write down an objective function which says you're going to attempt to maximize an entropy, P log P, subject to the constraints that the probability distribution sums to 1. It has the desired first order moment. Everything which is a desired moment calculated from the data has a bar over it. Later, if I'm calculating a moment within a test distribution, I'll use an angle bracket. And it has the desired second order moment. And you just turn the crank, and you find that the probability distribution looks, in a sense, Gaussian. Now remember, these are discrete variables. But it's quadratic in the argument of the exponential. And these lambdas are Lagrange multipliers that need to be determined so that you match the given first and second order moments in the data.
The I's are sequence positions.
The I's are sequence positions, and Xi alpha is running from 1 to 20, so it's referencing what amino acid is at sequence position I. How do you determine the lambdas? Well, it's possible to show, fairly easily in fact, that a function f defined to be log z plus this combination of the given data and the lambdas has its minimum when the expectation in the distribution equals the expectation in the data. That is, when you've achieved your goal. And furthermore, f is a convex function, so there's one unique minima, which is nice. And in fact, f is really just log of the probability of the observed data, all that data on that slide with the green columns, with the parametric form that came out of the maximum entropy analysis. And if you find the minimum of F by steepest descents, or maximize the negative of it by steepest ascents, then you find that you'll make a change in the parameter delta lambda ij, which is proportional to the difference between the moment that you want and the moment that you're getting at the current setting of the trial lambda ij's. Now, how do you calculate this expectation? Well, for a real protein sequence where the domain you're looking at is 40, 50, 60, 70 amino acids long, and you've got 20 amino acids in your alphabet, you know, there's an exponential number of states. So you're certainly not going to do it by explicit summation. However, you can do it by Markov chain Monte Carlo. And so that's what we do. We do a lot of Monte Carlo runs. Yeah, okay, this might actually finish in time. So, before turning this algorithm on for real proteins, that is a set of aligned sequences taken from the PFAM database, why don't we just investigate it first in a small model situation? So I'll construct a toy model. It'll be 10 sites long, and I just chose the connection matrix fairly at random to be this. Where there's a 1, it means the sites are connected. So, and I'm not worrying about directly connected, directly adjacent sites. So here it just so happened that 1 was connected to 2, but 1 is also connected to 10, etc. I defined a little contact potential, which I gather people probably talked about during the protein session earlier on, and evolved a bunch of sequences using that contact matrix and basically a little random contact potential with Monte Carlo, and I took about 500 sequences out of the equilibrium ensemble. And then I calculated on this slide, I'm just putting down the absolute value of the correlation matrix. So if it's italicized, it's statistically significant. So for example, position 1 and position 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 has statistically significant correlation because it's italicized. And yet, if you look at the connection matrix, there's a 0 between position 1 and position 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So you're picking up this network effect, not surprisingly.
When you describe this model, when you fix the connectivity and you put amino acid on it, which is an object, and you choose the contact potential between.
Right.
And then you let them evolve?
Yeah, and so then I just let it evolve with Monte Carlo. Well, I flip a spin. If it increases the energy, I accept it with an exponentially diminished probability. If it decreases the energy, I accept it.
You fix the contact potential.
Contact potential is fixed.
And then you allow the amino acids.
And then I allow the amino acids to mutate under.
The contact potential we heard the contact potential depends on what amino acid you're putting.
Right, so it's like, well, in the normal case, it would be a 20 by 20 matrix. Right? This is with a binary alphabet, but. Right. No. I mean, this is just to illustrate a conceptual point.
You don't put the overall constraint on sequence composition. You don't require the same number of zeros. One, this will be more or less the same.
No. And in contrast to the group of people who seriously investigate lattice models, and they take these little contact potentials and do very nice things with them, like Richard Goldstein, I'm not trying to draw conclusions about real proteins from this. I'm just trying to demonstrate what the algorithm does in a situation that has chaining of correlations. You can think of this as just an absolutely standard spin system that you're doing Monte Carlo on, and you'll reach the equilibrium distribution of that spin system, whatever it might be.
Frozen JIJ.
Frozen JIJ. And here's that correlation matrix, except it's in a graphical form. So solid lines are the actual connectivities that I put into the model, which were fixed. Dotted lines are statistically significant correlations between the positions, and you can easily see that you have some of this networking effect that, two and eight had statistically significant correlation, and yet they're not directly connected. Then let's run the maximum entropy algorithm and try and reconstruct the parameters of the contact potential and compare that to the contact map that we use to generate the sequence data. And the large values of the reconstructed parameters overlap where you had ones in the connection matrix. So you've successfully dechained the correlations that were going on. So, of course, I'm showing you this toy model because it worked perfectly. And I just really wanted to illustrate the conceptual point that if you take a collection of sequences and you calculate mutual information or correlation, you're going to have these dotted lines connecting nodes, whether they're amino acid positions or genes, all over the place. And this algorithm in this toy example ended up perfectly deducing that the direct connections were, in fact, the solid lines between the nodes. Now, what happens when you apply this to real proteins? Oh. This happens to be a graph that I lifted from a paper on genetic regulatory networks by Butte and Cohane. And all they did is they took this standard set of data that Eisen published in 98, and they, in fact, discretized the levels of expression. And so you can, in fact, think of it just like 20 amino acids, you know, however many levels of gene expression they had, and they calculated mutual information, and they wrote down the network of interactions. I think it will be an interesting question to investigate this network of gene interactions and see which of all those horrible lines are solid and which are dotted. That's in progress. Let me come back to amino acids. Oh, I told you I was going to present some theorems about how correlations add up.
We share an office.
Yeah. And it's published. It's in PhysReVI, volume 59. I'll give you the page. Super additive correlation. In fact, no, it's interesting. It's in this paper in PhysReV. PhysReV, volume 59, page 4983.
Basically, in the language of stained glass, it is you're given all the observation that stiff in correlation function, you're asked to deduce it there.
Yeah, it's like an inverse problem. Yeah. And the physical base. Only 2 point. Because in fact, for most families, the data doesn't support getting triple moments. So let me just throw a few more slides. Can I explain it? Sure. Yeah. Wait. I've got another slide coming. Okay. So it's actually pretty simple, and it all relies on the following simple little piece of algebra. If you have a node that I'll call a tail and a node that I'll call a head, and there's no direct line between the tail and the head, and there's one intermediate variable which I've called x1 here. Think of this as just a simple spin system. You sum over x1, which is called decimation in the literature, and it converts this diagram where you had the intermediate variable to a diagram where you insert a direct connection between the tail and the head, and the magnitude of the direct connection is just given by this equation. And if you have multiple pathways, what happens is the t's from the multiple pathways just add up, but each t is a fairly complicated nonlinear function of the original j's. Does that give enough flavor of what's going on? I'd be happy to talk about it later. No, this is explicitly for pathways that branch. This is explicitly for situations like this where you're considering a correlation between x0 and x4 and you have many branching pathways between them. It's explicitly for that situation.
If x1 is connected to something off to the side, you trace out x1, you lose information. Maybe you don't care.
Right. I mean, right.
Well, you can get fairly measured correlation between x0 and every other x. But in the end, you're trying to, I understand, you're trying to essentially say that correlation between x0 and any other x can be, comes together as this integral of all the between those two points. You don't care about the other connections you're drawing.
Right. I mean, suppose I had a situation where x0 and x4 was the largest correlation in the system, whether it be among amino acid positions or among gene expression genes. I would like to know if there's a direct connection between x0 and x4, or if there's conceivably converging indirect pathways like in this diagram. Oh, you can under certain particular architectures, but in general, you're right, you can't. On the other hand, if you just create random networks, you often find situations like this. In fact, the reason I got interested in this problem is when I was giving a talk and I just showed a random connectivity network, and somebody said, oh, look, the mutual information between those pair of nodes that are not connected is bigger than any of the other nodes. And I just randomly created that network. So these sorts of situations where you have multiple intervening pathways are not rare.
Now, I think that in neural networks, you can pose an analogous problem. You think of it as a measure, and you measure a similar time domain measure. You could have an algorithm that would produce the actual circuit.
I Yeah, I mean, there are multiple electrode recordings for neural networks, and I've had a couple of discussions with experimentalists about it.
Maybe one question, what do you mean by random connection? Go to your constraint in three dimensions, so it cannot be that random. It is constrained by...
No, I'm talking about the toy models that I'm creating.
Being high enough dimension that...
Well, okay, so I showed this slide earlier, and it's showing how the specificity sensitivity plot for this network deconvolution algorithm is better than the standard. Oh, okay, so that maybe that isn't clear to people. Okay, yeah. Right. The quick but somewhat incorrect answer, but it would give you the flavor of what we're doing, is we're looking at the magnitudes of the deduced lambdas, and we're doing something with them. In fact, what we're doing is calculating something called conditional mutual information, which would take me a few minutes to describe. But we're taking the final computed lambda ijs, and we're doing something with them, which is just an algebraic manipulation. And that gives us predictions of contacts. Then were you asking me to just explain what specificity and sensitivity means? So suppose that we perform the manipulation on the final lambda ijs, and we rank the predictions. Naively, you can think of it as, well, if the lambda ij is big, down to small, and the small ones probably aren't real. They're statistical fluctuations. The big ones are real. So if you take the top n predictions, specificity will be, of those top n predictions of contacts, what percentage of them are correct? Oh, the cutoff distance we took to be 10 angstroms between C alphas. And sensitivity will be, is of the n predictions that you've made, what percent of the actual contacts in the system did you get in those n predictions? And then if you plot specificity versus sensitivity, a perfect algorithm, you would like to see going up along one, and then, in other words, you'd like to have maximal area under the specificity sensitivity curve. And what I'm showing you here is a sensitivity specificity curve for our algorithm, and for the, let me just call it, simple pairwise mutual information approach, which doesn't take into account any network.
Yeah. Well, that simple mutual information calculation, why we, when you increase the sensitivity, you don't increase noise? The curve is pretty flat as you go from very small sensitivity to very high.
The dotted line must be random prediction.
The dotted line is random prediction, right.
It's only worse than random. It's not very random. I mean, if you just threw a dart and said these are the contacts, you would eventually end up with that.
Right. You mean?
So which one is your correct?
So at given sensitivity, the network deconvolution algorithm is having more of the predictions that it makes correct than the naive.
Yes, that's right. That the dash line across the middle is a random prediction.
Right.
Okay. So they both converge to random.
Right.
Out of tail. But prior to that, you get much better specificity at a given level of sensitivity.
Right, because as you're increasing the sensitivity, what you're doing is you're sort of dropping down in the levels of your predictions until you're getting all sorts of noise. And so they're coming down to the random. Well, maybe I should not give a slide of conclusions. I think, you know, at least a couple of the points I hope to get across, I hope maybe I've managed to convey. I mean, there was a few other points, but if people are interested, we can talk about it privately. And I was just going to throw the slide of references up, but I can't lay my hands on it at the moment. If you're interested, I can give you a few references. I should say, though, that the work on real proteins, these specificity sensitivity graphs, is we're just starting to write up the manuscript, so that isn't available. But the work on toy models and describing the algorithm, et cetera, that is available in the literature if you have an interest. So thank you.